north? The frantic voices echoed in Ellen's brain, louder and louder and louder, like the voice in her nightmare, until all she heard was noise. Stop it! She shouted, turning her face up into the punishing hot spray of the shower, trying to wash away the images sharp and painful in her memory. A child's body, the purple marks of strangulation, a circlet of bruises around his small throat. A child's body with a slip of paper pinned to the striped pajamas he wore. A message that cut to the bone. Some rise by sin, and some by virtue fall. A child's body discarded like a blown tire along the side of the road, abandoned at the base of the sign that welcomed visitors to Campion, a friendly place to live. The black humor, the twisted psychological intent of leaving the body when and where it was found, sickened Ellen almost as badly as the murder itself. The message was arrogance, disrespect for the police agencies involved, a callous disrespect for life, for decency, for small-town values, just as the note in the book had been a nose-thumbing at the court system, a sneering disregard for the sanctity and security of the courthouse. The total package of crimes that made up the game was among the worst she had ever dealt with. With the discovery of Dustin Holloman's body, the situation, difficult enough to this point, had reached critical mass. She could still hear the hysterical sobs of the Holloman family, the shaky voices of the cops. Even the coroner, the irascible Stuart Oglethorpe, had wept as Dustin's lifeless body was zipped into the too big black bag and loaded into the hearse. Ellen had held herself together as best she could, struggling to put a brave face over the emotions that ravaged her. She represented justice. If any entity needed to show strength in the face of evil, it was justice. The people looked to her, to the system, to make things right, to avenge the wrongs. She had to stand strong. A blessed numbness had descended to insulate her. The miraculous self-protective properties of the human psyche at work. She had gone through all the motions, consulted with Steiger and Wilhelm as the evidence techs from the BCA mobile lab processed the scene under the harsh white glare of the portable halogen lights. Individual faces in the surrounding crowd caught in her peripheral vision. Henry Forster from the Star Tribune, a correspondent from Dateline. Jay. He had come there for the story. The cynic in her reminded her of that fact, but it couldn't discount the bleak expression on his face, or the sound of his voice, when several of the reporters had turned to him for opinions when they could get no answers from anyone else.
"It's a tragedy," he said in a rough, low voice. "There's nothing I can say to make it any less senseless."
His words stayed with her, as she prepared herself for the day, slicking her hair back into a twist, selecting her best black suit from the closet. Dustin Holloman's death was a tragedy that should never have happened anywhere, but most of all not here. This was a crime against the community of Park County, the murder of a collective innocence. "Ignorance is not innocence, but sin." Garrett Wright and his shadow may have viewed the innocence of this place as ignorance, but the sin was theirs, and they would be made to pay. They would damn well be made to pay. The vow burned in Ellen's mind, in her heart. She would see to it. She hadn't asked for this battle, hadn't wanted it to come here, but she would fight it with everything she had. Not giving a damn if the reporters followed her, she drove across town to the new office complex on Ramsey Drive, where Costello had rented a suite for his stay here. The extravagance sickened her. This was what Tony Costello was all about. Money, power, a staff of drones to do the work, an image polished to a diamond shine. She marched past the secretary, homing in on Costello, who stood in the hall giving orders to one of his associates. Dorman's eyes widened at the sight of her. Costello's expression was guarded.
"Have you heard?" she demanded.
"About the Holloman boy?
He's dead."
Costello reached for her arm. "Let's go in my office." Ellen jerked away from his touch.
"Let's not. I'd rather your staff hear exactly what kind of a bastard they're working for, if they don't already know."
Anger flashed in his dark eyes,
and he took another step toward her. Ellen, you're out of line.
I'm out of line? My God!
She shook her head in disbelief. You could have saved that child. You could have at least been a coward and called in anonymously. But if Wright's accomplice is nailed, then Wright is nailed too, and you'll be damned if you'll lose a case over something as trivial as a child's life.
She could see the secretary, wide-eyed and uncertain. Another associate, an African-American woman, stepped into the hall from an office, looking shocked. Costello's face was a stony mask.
You'll be damned, all right, Ellen snarled. I'm filing a complaint with the Professional Relations Board today. If I find one shred of evidence linking you to that boy's murderer, I will ruin you, Tony. You're as guilty of his death as if you put your hands around his throat and choked him yourself.
She stormed out of the office, half expecting him to follow. But he didn't. She had taken him by surprise, knocked him back on his heels, and she could imagine what he was thinking. No time to appear in front of the press that waited in the hall. Better to say nothing, leave them wondering, leave her to deal with them, the cold-hearted son of a bitch. She pushed past the reporters, letting them draw their own conclusions as to why she would pay a visit to the opposition less than 2 hours before they were due in court. By the time she arrived at the courthouse, the full flock of vultures had descended. The scene in Campion had been processed and abandoned, picked clean of details and metaphors, photographed from every possible angle. They perched themselves on the main steps of the courthouse, hovered around all the entrances. The only way into the building was to run the gauntlet, eyes forward, stride purposeful, mouth closed. They hurled their questions at her like stones and chased her into the building, demanding the answers she had refused them just hours before.
Ms. North, how will the discovery of Dustin Holloman's body affect the charges against Garrett Wright?
Ms. North, are you ready to admit you're prosecuting the wrong man?
What were you doing at Anthony Costello's offices? Will there be some kind of deal? Are you dropping the charges? Ms. North, are you holding to your accomplice theory? Will you try to pin this on the sci-fi cowboys?
Does the Park County Attorney's Office have anything to say for itself?
Yes.
She tossed a glare over her shoulder, without breaking stride. I have a hearing to prepare for, and a suspect who's as guilty as sin. If you let this latest atrocity sway you from believing that, then you're just buying into his sick game, and you're as much accomplices as the person who dumped that child's body.
If she had meant her words to silence or humiliate them, she would have been disappointed. As it was, the rise in volume as they all clamored to speak at once came as no great surprise.
Just like old times, she thought as she stepped past the deputy, who had been stationed outside the office door. Only worse. The office was in a state of stunned chaos. Phones rang incessantly and seemed to go unanswered. One of the secretaries from Campion sat at her desk, weeping. Phoebe knelt on the floor beside the woman's chair, offering Kleenex and sympathy, her own eyes red-rimmed and brimming with tears. Rudy stood in the center of it all, looking like a captain on the deck of a sinking ship.
"This is an absolute nightmare," he said half under his breath, glaring at Ellen as if the idea of dumping Dustin Holloman's body in plain sight mere hours before the probable cause hearing had been her idea. "Bill Glendenning called me at home to demand an explanation. He said from the position of his office, it appears you've lost all control of the situation, Ellen."
"You, not we," Ellen noted, as she went into her office, Rudy following. He was ready to cut the ties and blame her in order to save his ass and his prospective judgeship. She wheeled on him.
"I've lost control? I never had control. I had a case to build, and I built it. I'm not omnipotent. If I were in control, none of this would ever have happened."
"You know what I mean."
"Yes, I certainly do."
She didn't care that Quentin Adler stood just behind him in the doorway, soaking up every word to be regurgitated later at the water cooler.
"You've really painted yourself into a corner this time, haven't you, Rudy? You dumped this case on me because you didn't have the guts to take it on yourself."
"Now what?" she demanded.
"God forbid you should look at the evidence we have against Garrett Wright and back me up."
"I've backed you in this from the beginning, Ellen," he said indignantly. "I gave you my full confidence. I gave you free rein."
He had given her ample rope,
and half hoped she would hang herself with it, but not before he could get himself clear of her kicking feet. He had never, in all his scheming scenarios, imagined anything as dire as this latest turn of events. If he washed his hands of her now, he would appear weak. If he backed her and she failed, she would take the brunt of the criticism, but the fallout would be on him. His decision-making abilities would be questioned. His qualifications as a judge would be questioned. He could almost feel the robes slipping from his grasp.
"Do I need to remind you Mitch Holt ran down Garrett Wright himself?" Ellen asked. "He's guilty."
"Not of killing that Holloman boy."
"That's not the case we're hearing. But don't worry, Rudy. When that one comes in, I will be first in line. I want to nail that son of a bitch's hide to the wall and pick my teeth with his bones. Now, if you'll excuse me," she said, backing him out into the hall, "I've got a battle to wage."
"All rise. Court is in session. The Honorable Judge Gorman Grabko presiding."
The bailiff smashed the gavel down again as the noisy crowd surged to its feet. Jay watched as Gorman Grabko emerged from his chambers with a theatrical air of dignity, bald head polished to a high sheen, beard neatly trimmed. A gray-striped bow tie perched above the neck of his robes, properly discreet. He climbed up to his aerie on the bench and settled himself with quiet ceremony, arranging his stack of files and books just so, before looking out on the assembled mob that filled his courtroom shoulder to shoulder. Jay followed the judge's eyes, trying to imagine the scene from Grabko's point of view. Looking past the counsel tables into the gallery, he would see Paul Kirkwood sitting in the front row with a sour expression, Rudy Stovich right beside him, his greased gray hair rising off one side of his head like a loose asphalt shingle. He would see Mitch Holt in a suit and tie, and Megan O'Malley wearing the ugly badges of her beating, bruises that had reached the pomegranate and puce stage, stitches crawling over her lower lip like a centipede. The Harris College contingent had arrayed themselves on the other side of the aisle, behind the defense table. Christopher Priest and the assistant dean, a cadre of students. Todd Childs, noticeably absent. Karen Wright, looking fragile and lovely in rose petal pink. And the press all around. From his lofty seat, Grabko could literally look down on the lawyers, every judge's secret joy. At the prosecution table, Ellen stood, her back rigid, her jaw rigid, her hands curled into fists at her sides. She was furious, almost to the point of shaking, Jay would have bet. And he had a sinking feeling her temper was directly attributable to the discussion that had gone on in chambers moments before, where Grabko would have announced to the lawyers his decisions on motions they had made prior to today. Costello had filed two of note, had broadcast them to the press with fanfare, a motion to dismiss and a motion to suppress the lineup identification. He stood at the defense table with his associate, smartly decked out in a tailored tobacco-brown suit, black hair gleaming almost blue under the lights, his expression allowing just a hint of overconfidence. Christ! Would Grabko have been so easily led? Would the news of the Holloman boy's death have swayed him, as it had many of the reporters who had been on the scene in the pearl gray hours before dawn? His decision on the dismissal had to be based on the evidence regarding the issue of the constitutionality of the arrest, but that didn't mean other factors couldn't influence him subconsciously or otherwise. If Grabko had been sufficiently starstruck by Costello, if he had already been leaning toward the defense, anxiety knotted in Jay's gut. He hadn't been able to get the morning's images out of his head. In the usual course of his job, he had seen hundreds of crime scene photos, some grisly beyond imagining. But he had never actually been to a scene like this one. He would never forget the sight of that small, lifeless body, would never forget the raw, nameless emotion that had cut through him, or the anguished keening of the boy's mother. There were no words to describe the kind of desperate tension that had thickened the cold air along that stretch of road leading into Campion. Acrid, volatile, like a toxic chemical cloud that could have ignited and exploded at the slightest spark. And he knew it was all part of the master plan, mapped out by Wright and his partner. A move meant to shock, meant to thumb their noses at their opponents in the game.
Some rise by sin, and some by virtue fall.
Who represented virtue more than the police, more than the prosecutor, more than a child? The goal was to get away with murder, to defeat the justice system, and destroy the servants of that system in the process, and to destroy two innocent families in the bargain. The pure evil of it was stunning. And fewer people were willing to believe the defendant standing at the table was capable of embodying that evil. Evil was supposed to be ugly, instantly recognizable. Not a respected college professor who rehabilitated delinquents. Not an attractive, quiet man in a conservative blue suit.
"Be seated," Grabko intoned.
He perched a pair of half-glasses on his nose and consulted a document, as if he had no idea what case was coming up before him.
"We are here on the matter of the state versus Dr. Garrett Wright. This is the omnibus hearing. For those of you in the gallery unfamiliar with our system, the omnibus hearing is the equivalent of a probable cause hearing, wherein the state bears the burden of proof to show that the defendant indeed may have committed the crimes of which he stands accused and should be bound over for trial."
"Counsel for the defense," he announced. "Please state your names for the record." Costello and his minion rose in unison.
"Anthony Costello, Your Honor.
Assisting me will be my associate, Mr. Dorman."
"Counsel for the prosecution."
"Assistant County Attorney Ellen North, Your Honor."
"Assistant County Attorney Cameron Reed, Your Honor."
"Mr. Costello,"
Grabko said, turning his attention back to the defense. "Regarding your previously filed motion to dismiss on the grounds that in the process of arresting Dr. Wright, the Deer Lake Police Force violated his rights under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, I have carefully considered your argument and weighed all factors involved, including Chief Holt's statement and the prosecution's argument."
He paused for effect, stroking a hand down his beard, as if he were just now coming to his conclusion.
Jay pulled in a breath and held it.
"I find your argument has merit. There was a certain delay between pursuit and apprehension, wherein Chief Holt lost sight of his suspect."
A gasp went up in the gallery. In the front row, Paul Kirkwood leaned forward to grasp the railing, as if preparing to vault over it.
"However," Grabko said, "the length of the delay is in dispute, and I am convinced the rule of exigent circumstances applied. Therefore, motion to dismiss is denied."
Another wave of sound rolled through the courtroom. Grabko banged his gavel and frowned at the gallery.
"I will have order in this courtroom. This hearing is a legal proceeding, not a play. Those in the gallery will remain silent or be removed."
Threat made, he resettled himself like a tom turkey that had had his feathers ruffled. He carefully set aside the documents concerning the first motion and took up another.
"With regards to the defense motion to suppress the lineup identification, motion granted."
Ellen rose from her chair as the gallery behind her defied fate and burst into a cacophony of sound.
"Your Honor!"
she shouted over the noise as Grabko cracked his gavel down.
"Your Honor, I request the record show—"
"Ms. North,"
Grabko snapped, scowling at her over the rims of his glasses.
"You made your opinion of my ruling abundantly clear in chambers. Unless you would care to be served with a charge of contempt, I suggest you not make it again."
Biting down on her temper, she did a mental count to 10.
"Yes, Your Honor."
"You may call your first witness, Ms. North."
"The state calls Agent Megan O'Malley."
Mitch gave Megan's good hand a squeeze. She rose from her seat on the aisle and made her way slowly through the gate and toward the witness stand, trying not to lean too heavily against her crutch, too aware of the eyes that followed her. Scrutinizing, speculating. The bailiff hovered at her shoulder as if he expected her to swoon. She backed him off with an icy glare and took her time climbing into the witness box. Standing behind the table, Ellen assessed her witness as Megan was sworn in, noting with grim satisfaction that the BCA agent had taken no measures to cover the damage that had been done to her. She wore no makeup and had pulled her dark hair back off her neck, revealing the fading choke marks around her throat.
Agent O'Malley, Ellen began, please state for the record your occupation.
I am... was...
the Deer Lake Regional Field Agent for the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
You say was. Has your status with the Bureau changed recently?
Yes, Megan answered grudgingly. I'm currently on medical leave.
Due to injuries suffered on January 22, 1994?
Yes.
Agent O'Malley, you were the agent in charge of the investigation of the abduction of Josh Kirkwood, were you not?
That's correct.
And were you investigating that crime on the 22nd?
Yes, I was.
Would you please tell the court what happened on that morning?
Objection,
Costello said in a bored tone.
Relevance.
Ellen cut him a look. Goes to motive, Your Honor. We intend to establish a chronology of events that led to the vicious attack against Agent O'Malley.
Grabko pursed his lips and nodded.
Overruled.
Ellen stepped out from behind the table and walked slowly toward the witness stand, pulling Grabko's attention away from Costello.
Please continue, Agent O'Malley.
I had stopped my car on the side of Old Cedar Road, got out of the vehicle, and was examining a set of skid marks made on the road during an auto accident that had taken place on the night of Josh Kirkwood's abduction, directly prior to his abduction.
Why were you interested in the accident site?
I was suspicious of the cause and the timing of the accident. The resulting injuries to the drivers and passengers delayed Josh Kirkwood's mother, Dr. Hannah Garrison, in leaving the hospital to pick him up from hockey practice. In the time between the accident and Dr. Garrison's arrival at the ice arena, Josh was abducted.
And while you were examining these skid marks, were you approached by anyone?
Yes. Dr. Garrett Wright stopped and expressed an interest in my purpose for being there. I simply said I was checking something out.
To the best of your knowledge, was Dr. Wright aware of the accident that had taken place?
Yes, he was. The driver of the car that caused the accident was a student at Harris College who was involved in a project Dr. Wright and Professor Christopher Priest were heading.
Did you see Dr. Wright again later that day?
Yes. I went to Harris College looking for Professor Priest. The professor wasn't in his office, but I found Dr. Wright there, along with a student.
How was Dr. Wright dressed at that time?
He was wearing a shirt and tie and dark trousers.
You spoke to him then?
Yes. Dr. Wright informed me that Priest had gone to St. Peter and would likely return to his home around 2:30 p.m.
Was Dr. Wright aware of your intention to go to his colleague's home?
He offered to give me directions.
Did you inform anyone else of your intention to go to Priest's home?
No.
And where is Professor Priest's home located?
10226 Stone Quarry Trail, outside of town.
In a wooded, relatively isolated area, correct?
Yes.
When you arrived at that location, was Professor Priest at home?
No. The house was locked and dark. There was no car. I proceeded to walk around the property, the south end of which abuts Quarry Hills Park. As I neared the end of a storage shed on the southeast corner of the property, I saw a trail of footprints in the snow leading from the south, the park, into the shed. I found that suspicious, so I drew my weapon, announced myself as a law enforcement officer, and demanded the person in the shed come out.
Did the person come out?
No.
What happened then?
Megan blinked slowly, the scene flashing in broken frames behind her eyelids like a poorly spliced film. A weird twilight quality to the afternoon. The sky leaden, snow falling thick and heavy. A forest of black, winter-dead trees surrounded the property.
I decided to go back to my vehicle and radio for backup, she said.
Her heart beat a little harder. She was moving past the shed. 30 feet, and she would be clear of it. She got no farther than 15.
Someone burst out of the shed.
The first blow struck with a power that sent her sprawling headlong. The gun flew out of her hand. She could see it, sailing away, falling, disappearing into the snow. She lunged toward it, kicking, flailing like a beached swimmer.
I tried to get the gun. He came down on top of me.
Black clothing, ski mask, eyes, and a mouth. A short black club swinging down at her.
He struck me, she said, the tension building in her chest. With a baton, like a nightstick, hard.
Again, a
and again, hitting her shoulder, hitting her a glancing blow off the side of her head, striking her right hand as she held it up in defense, the blow so vicious that the pain roared up her arm and exploded in her brain. The memory of the pain brought a wave of nausea. She pulled a slow, unsteady breath deep into her lungs.
"I lost consciousness," she said quietly.
"When you regained consciousness, where were you?"
"Tied to a chair. I don't know the location."
"Can you describe the surroundings?"
"I was blindfolded. I had only a small wedge of vision at the bottom of the blindfold."
Ellen paused, resting a hand on the smooth old wood of the witness stand as gently as if it were Megan's hand. From this close, she could see that Megan's ashen pallor had nothing to do with the quality of the lighting, and that despite the coolness of the room, a fine film of perspiration misted her forehead.
"Megan, I realize this is difficult for you," she said, with genuine sympathy, "but will you tell us what happened while you were held captive in this place?"
Megan swallowed hard. Control. She was a cop. She had testified a million times. She had never been a victim. She turned a narrow gaze on Garrett Wright, sitting so calm, beaming false innocence, and damned him to the vilest, blackest corner of hell.
"He beat me repeatedly," she said, cursing the tears that filled her eyes. Damned if she would let them fall. "He choked me. He talked about killing me. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. He talked about taking Josh. He called it a game."
"And he made you a pawn in his game, didn't he?
He told me I would be their next move."
And the sense of helplessness and humiliation had nearly been worse than the pain. "Agent O'Malley, even though you couldn't see your assailant's face, you came to a conclusion about his identity. How did you arrive at this conclusion?"
"Only two people knew I had gone to Priest's home, Garrett Wright being one of them. He had also seen me examining the skid marks at the accident site. If he was involved, he would have known I was onto something. I had met and spoken with Dr. Wright on several occasions. I was familiar with his patterns of speech. I knew his height in relation to my own. I had also noticed he had a pronounced habit of rocking back on his heels. I could see a section of floor beside my chair. I saw his boots. Saw him rocking back on his heels while he went on and on about how brilliant he was," she said bitterly.
"And did he say anything specific that rang a bell with you?"
"Yes. I asked him why he had singled out Josh. Why the Kirkwoods? With great contempt, he said, 'Why not? Such a perfect little family.' When I'd spoken with Dr. Wright earlier in the day, he used the same phrase to describe the Kirkwoods. Such a perfect family."
Ellen walked away from the stand, letting the testimony hang there, not only for Grabko, but for the press as well. Let them look at Megan, bruised and beaten. Let them look at the well-dressed, well-groomed man who stood accused and begin to realize what a monster they had in their midst. Slipping her reading glasses on, Ellen chose a report from the documents Cameron had spread out on the table. "The injuries you suffered at the hands of this man were severe, weren't they?"
"Yes.
According to the medical report, marked People's Exhibit C, you sustained a concussion, multiple severe contusions, bruised kidneys, cracked ribs, damage to your right knee. Nearly every bone in your right hand sustained multiple fractures, extensive damage that will require a number of operations if you're to have any hope of regaining mobility." She paused, looking up at Megan with sympathy, with apology. "Agent O'Malley, considering the extent of the damage to your hand, can you realistically hope you'll ever be able to resume your full duties as a field agent for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension?" The question hit Megan like a brick to the solar plexus. The answer was one she had evaded and denied and lain awake nights contemplating. It scared the hell out of her. All she had ever wanted in life was to be a good cop, and if she couldn't be a cop, then what was she? Who was she? The tears blurred her vision, and she blinked furiously as she lifted her chin to a proud angle.
"It's not likely. No. Ellen glared at Costello.
Your witness.
He rose, his expression cool, unmoved, his brows drawing together as he consulted a newspaper clipping.
I have to confess, I'm a little confused here, Agent O'Malley. You've told the court you were investigating aspects of the Kirkwood abduction on the 22nd. Is that correct?
Yes.
But according to an article in the Star Tribune, dated Saturday, January 22nd, you had already been officially relieved of your post, temporarily suspended from active duty. According to your special agent in charge, Bruce DePalma, you had been replaced in the Deer Lake region by Agent Martin Wilhelm the day before because of your mishandling of the investigation.
That's a lie, Megan said sharply.
Costello arched a brow. You're calling your special agent in charge a liar?
No, Mr. Costello, she said plainly. I'm calling you a liar.
Judge Grabko gave a little jolt in his seat, scowling ferociously.
Agent O'Malley, I expect a certain decorum in my courtroom, especially from those in law enforcement.
Megan made no effort to apologize. If the pompous old fart wanted contrition, he'd damn well have to ask for it. Costello pressed on, having no desire to break his rhythm. You'd been working the case for 10 days with no satisfactory result. One suspect had died in custody.
Objection!
Ellen snapped, rising. There's no point to this attack. Agent O'Malley isn't on trial. Your Honor, we feel Agent O'Malley's status with the BCA, as well as her mental state on the 22nd, are very much factors here.
This is a hearing, Mr. Costello, Ellen said, not a trial. You have the right to cross-examine the witnesses, not impeach them.
Grabko smacked his gavel down.
This is my courtroom, Ms. North. I will oversee the implementation of the rules.
Yes, Your Honor, she said tightly. Please do.
Objection overruled. Please continue, Mr. Costello.
Costello stepped out from behind the table and sauntered into the open area in front of the bench. Had you been directed by Special Agent in Charge DePalma to appear at BCA headquarters in St. Paul on Saturday the 22nd?
Yes, Megan admitted grudgingly.
And yet you were wandering around Deer Lake, looking at skid marks, asking questions, by your own admission, continuing an investigation that you no longer had any connection to. Is that correct?
No. I still felt a very strong connection to the case. Josh was still missing. I still had questions. I felt obligated to try to get answers. Appearing at headquarters did not outweigh the need to find a child in danger and apprehend the creep responsible.
So you defied direct orders from your superior?
Delayed.
Because you didn't want to let go of the case?
I may not have been agent in charge of the investigation any longer, but I was still a cop, Megan said. I felt a moral obligation.
There was quite a lot of hoopla surrounding your assignment to the Deer Lake region, wasn't there?
Costello asked, changing lanes with the skill of a Grand Prix driver.
I guess. You're being modest. You were the first woman in the history of the BCA to hold a field post. Isn't that right? He said with phony amazement.
Yes.
There was a great deal of pressure on you to solve the Kirkwood case, more so than if you had been a man.
I wouldn't know, Megan said deadpan. I've never been a man.
Snickers rattled through the gallery. Grabko bumped his gavel and glared at them. The press was scrutinizing, quite literally, your every move. Costello went on. Headquarters was breathing down your neck. You were operating under tremendous stress. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes.
And you wanted very badly to solve the case. In fact, your very career was riding on it.
I wanted to solve the case. That was my job.
You were desperate.
Determined.
Costello turned his profile to the gallery and smiled the charming wide white smile, shaking his head. You have a stubborn propensity for rationalization, Agent O'Malley.
Objection, Ellen snapped.
Sustained. Please confine yourself to questions, Mr. Costello.
He nodded slightly and moved back to the defense table.
Dorman sat at attention like a trick poodle, holding out the proper statement, which Costello accepted and paged through. Agent O'Malley, at any time during the course of the investigation, was Dr. Wright considered a suspect in the disappearance of Josh Kirkwood?
No, not until he abducted and assaulted me and Chief Holt ran him down.
A muscle ticked in Costello's jaw.
His dark eyes flashed as he turned toward Grabko. The judge leaned over the witness stand, temper rouging his cheeks above his beard.
"Agent O'Malley, I'm quite certain you know better than to answer in such a manner. Do so again, and you may be held in contempt."
"Yes, Your Honor." She tipped her head in a way that would seem deferential to Grabko, but kept him from seeing her eyes.
"Isn't it true," Costello went on, "that in fact you had considered a number of other people as suspects, including Paul Kirkwood?"
"As dictated by standard operating procedures involving abductions, the immediate family was considered as part of the dual investigation."
"You were a little more rigorous in your consideration of Paul Kirkwood than someone just going through the motions."
Megan narrowed her eyes at him. "I'm a good cop. I never just go through the motions."
"That's admirable. So you were dead serious when you brought Mr. Kirkwood in to be fingerprinted?"
"Mr. Kirkwood was fingerprinted for elimination purposes only."
"You spoke with Dr. Wright and his student on the 22nd, Costello said, switching tacks again. "But you actually went to Harris College in search of Professor Christopher Priest, is that right?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"I wanted to ask him some questions."
"Did you consider him a suspect?"
"There was that possibility."
"You gave Dr. Wright the impression that you would be going out to Christopher Priest's residence later that day. Can you say whether or not Dr. Wright or Todd Childs might have spoken about that afterward with other people?"
"I couldn't say."
"Is it possible your conversation might have been overheard by someone in the hall outside the office?"
"I couldn't say."
"So you can't conclusively say that Dr. Wright was only one of two people who knew you were going to Professor Priest's home?"
"To my knowledge, he was."
"What time was it when you arrived at Priest's home?"
"Approximately 1:45 p.m.
Costello arched a brow for his audience. "But Dr. Wright had specified Priest wouldn't be back until around 2:30. Why did you get there so early?"
Megan cocked her head to a belligerent angle.
"I wanted to be there to welcome him home."
"Agent O'Malley," Grabko cautioned.
"You considered him a suspect," Costello said.
"Asked and answered," Ellen said wearily, rising. "Your Honor, can we ask Mr. Costello to cut to the chase here? It simply isn't relevant whether there was one suspect or a dozen. Dr. Wright is the man who was apprehended."
Grabko's face tightened, as if he wanted to deny her, but couldn't. "Let's move on, Mr. Costello."
Costello didn't bat an eye.
"Agent O'Malley, did you see the face of the person who attacked you at the Priest residence?"
He hit her from the side, sent her sprawling. The gun flew out of her hand.
"No." "Did you see the face of the person who assaulted you while you were held at this undisclosed location?"
The pain came from all directions at once, striking her shoulder, her knee, her hand, again and again.
"Agent O'Malley?"
"I saw his feet."
Costello looked indignant. "And on the basis of that, you would have us try a respected member of the community for heinous crimes?"
"No, I..."
"Did you recognize his voice?"
"You think we'll kill you, clever girl? You wouldn't be the first by a long, long way."
A whisper. Soft. Disembodied.
"No, but..."
Costello wheeled away from her. "You didn't see him, couldn't recognize him, he never spoke his name," he said, his voice growing louder with every syllable.
He flung her written statement down onto the table and turned back toward her.
"Is there anything you can tell us, former Agent O'Malley, that should make us believe your conclusion that your assailant was Dr. Garrett Wright is anything more than the desperate grasping of a woman who bungled the case and had to do something to keep her career from going down the toilet?"
"Objection!" Ellen shouted.
Grabko pounded for order. The sounds were blocked in Megan's mind by the white noise of fury. The fine thread on her control snapped, and the rage poured through her and out of her.
"I can tell you he's guilty!" she shouted, coming up out of her seat. "I can tell you he's a sick son of a bitch who thinks it's a game to steal children and ruin lives, and he deserves worse than anything this court will do to him!"
"Order!"
Grabko screamed, pounding like a carpenter. The head snapped off his gavel and sailed at the defense table.
"Order!"
The bailiff started toward the witness stand, but jumped back at the sight of Megan's crutch. Megan's focus was on Costello, who stood no more than a foot away, his face calm, his dark eyes bright, the barest hint of a smile tightening the corners of his mouth.
"Oh, God, O'Malley, you played right into his hands. Way to go!"
She had to appear just exactly as he had wanted to paint her. Obsessed, biased, out of control, desperate. The realization made her feel ill, dizzy. She sank weakly back into her chair and closed her eyes.
"No further questions," Costello said, and walked calmly back toward his client.
Chapter 31. "The state calls Chief of Police Mitch Holt," Ellen said calmly, as if her first witness hadn't just been hustled out of the courtroom. She didn't blame Megan for losing her poise. Considering what Wright had put her through, it was a wonder she hadn't pulled a gun and shot him, and Costello too, while she was at it. The big question in Ellen's mind was what impact Megan's emotional testimony would have. The press might take her side, or not, but Grabko was clearly pissed off. This hearing was his show, and Megan had upstaged him. Would he look at her testimony and see anything but red? With luck, Mitch would settle the judge and the gallery. He made an excellent witness, businesslike, his face set in the stony, no-nonsense expression of a veteran detective. He took the stand and swore the oath, his gaze fixed on the defense table. "Chief Holt, will you please tell the court about the events that occurred on the night of January 22nd? Ellen prompted. "At approximately 8:45 p.m., I received a call from Agent O'Malley," Mitch said. "She was in obvious distress. She wasn't allowed to say much. Then, an unidentified male came on the line and instructed me to go alone to the southwest entrance of Quarry Hills Park at 9:15.
"Did he say why?"
"He said they had a present for me, that they wanted to win the game."
"And you went to the park as instructed?"
"Not as instructed. I immediately sent an unmarked car with two officers to the southeast entrance of the park, another to the southwest, and came into the park myself on foot from the west."
"Where the park adjoins the lakeside neighborhood?"
"Yes. I waited in the cover of the trees. At 9:05, a late-model GMC 4x4 truck entered the park, drove some distance along the road and stopped. The driver got out, went to the passenger side and let the passenger out, then marched her approximately 30 feet back to the south."
Megan, limping heavily, unquestionably badly injured. The fury he had felt then burned again like a coal.
"A struggle ensued between them," he stated flatly. "I ran out from the woods with my weapon drawn, announced myself as a police officer, and ordered them to freeze."
"At this point, did you recognize either person?"
"Yes, I recognized Agent O'Malley. The assailant was wearing a ski mask."
"Was he armed?"
"Yes. He had a 9mm semi-automatic handgun."
"And was he threatening Agent O'Malley?"
"Yes. At one point, he had the gun pressed to her temple."
And Mitch had known a wrong move, a wrong decision, and she would be dead right there and then, before his eyes.
"I ordered him to drop the weapon, informed him he was under arrest," he went on. "Agent O'Malley knocked him off balance. He pushed her at me, fired several rounds, and jumped back into the truck, which was still running. I jumped into the back of the truck, fired a shot through the back window in order to break the glass, ordered him to stop the truck."
"Did he?"
"No. He returned fire, then lost control of the vehicle."
The truck roared off the path and into space, landed bucking, skidded sideways, sending up a spray of snow.
"I was thrown clear. The truck slammed into a tree."
"You then pursued the suspect on foot?"
"Yes. He ran west, into the woods, and up the hill toward Lakeside, occasionally stopping to fire at me."
"Were you hit?"
"One shot cut through the sleeve of my coat and grazed my arm."
"But you continued pursuit?"
"Yes. At one point he discarded his ski mask. I found it lying on the ground along the trail."
"What did you do with it?"
"Left it where it was. The crime scene unit later photographed it in place, then bagged it as evidence and sent it to the BCA lab to be processed."
"Your Honor," Ellen addressed Grabko as Cameron rose and presented several photographs to the clerk. "The ski mask itself is still at the BCA lab,
but the state would like to introduce the crime scene photographs in its stead for the purpose of this hearing.
Mr. Costello? Grabko asked, arching a brow. No objections, Your Honor.
Grabko nodded to his clerk. Receive the photographs into evidence.
Where did the suspect appear to be headed? Ellen asked, turning back to Mitch.
The Lakeside subdivision, Mitch said. He ran up through the backyards of the houses on Lakeshore Drive.
Running along the cross-country ski trail, darting in and out between the snow-frosted spruce trees, the cold air like razors in his lungs, thinking how insane it was to be chasing a college professor who drove a Saab and worked with juvenile offenders.
I pursued the suspect through the yards, heading north. I saw him let himself into a garage through the back door, followed him in, took him down, and arrested him.
And is that man sitting in the courtroom?
Yes, he is.
He glared at the man whose game had shredded the fabric of life in Deer Lake irreparably.
Dr. Garrett Wright, the defendant.
Thank you, Chief Holt, Ellen said with a nod. No further questions.
Mitch watched Costello rise, wondering if he would play the same game he had played with Megan, moving closer and closer into her space until she lashed out at him. He would have liked the chance to lash out at Costello, himself, preferably in a dark alley with no witnesses. It had killed him to sit impassively in the gallery watching Megan unravel. A female bailiff had escorted her from the stand into the jury room after her final outburst. He wanted only one thing more than he wanted to go to her, and that was to nail the lid on Garrett Wright's coffin.
Chief Holt,
Costello began, standing at ease behind the defense table.
You testify the suspect was wearing a ski mask when you first encountered him in the park. You did not see his face at that time?
No.
Did he speak to you?
No.
The truck he was driving was registered to whom?
Roy Strandberg, who was in Arizona at the time. The truck was stolen.
And were Dr. Wright's fingerprints found in this truck?
No.
And when you were pursuing the suspect through the woods, did you see him discard the ski mask? Did you see his face?
No.
That's a fairly dense woods, isn't it, Chief Holt? A lot of trees?
That would be the definition of a woods, yes, Mitch said dryly.
You didn't have a clear and constant view of the suspect, did you?
Not constant, no, but the gunfire kept me apprised of his whereabouts.
Another snicker ran through the gallery, but Costello jumped onto the opportunity.
And when you apprehended Dr. Wright, was he in possession of a weapon?
No.
According to the statements, Dr. Wright's hands were later tested for gunpowder residue and the tests were negative. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Costello steepled his fingers and arranged his features in a contemplative mien.
So you're running through the woods. It's dark. It's snowing. You're dodging gunfire, dodging trees. You lost sight of your suspect more than once, didn't you?
I saw him just fine when he went into that garage.
But you had lost sight of him prior to that.
For no more than seconds.
How many seconds?
I didn't time the instances.
5 seconds, 10, 20.
Less than 20, less than 15.
But you have no way of knowing for certain.
No.
So it could be possible that the man you saw going into that garage wasn't your suspect at all, isn't that right?
That would be unlikely.
But possible.
Remotely.
Prior to making the actual arrest, did you have any reason to believe the suspect you were chasing was Dr. Wright?
Agent O'Malley had told me it was Dr. Wright.
I see.
Costello said with an exaggerated nod. He turned sideways, cocking a hip against the table, absently twirling a pencil in his hands.
Chief Holt, when you received that phone call from Agent O'Malley and heard that she was in distress, in danger, what did that make you feel?
Mitch squinted at him, suspicious.
I don't follow. Were you in fear for her life?
Of course.
And when you saw her in Quarry Hills Park, and she was obviously badly wounded, did that make you angry?
Objection, Ellen said, looking askance at Costello. Is there a point to this?
A very sharp one, Your Honor.
Grabko nodded.
Proceed. Answer the question, Chief Holt.
Yes.
It made you angry. You were frightened for her. You wanted to get the person responsible. You wanted that badly.
That's my job.
But your feelings went beyond a professional concern, didn't they? Isn't it true? You and Agent O'Malley are involved?
Objection!
Ellen surged to her feet.
This is absolutely outside the scope of this hearing. We're here to review facts and evidence, not the personal lives of police officers.
Grabko smacked his new gavel.
I don't want to hear another lecture from you, Ms. North, he snapped.
Mr. Costello, perhaps you'd better state your point for the court.
Ellen tossed her pencil down and crossed her arms.
Do you have a problem with my suggestion, Ms. North?
Grabko asked coolly.
Yes, I do, Your Honor. It gives Mr. Costello the opportunity to present his case to the press, which is very likely the reason he went down this road in the first place.
Grabko stuck his lower lip out like a pouting child.
The outcome of this hearing will not be based on the opinions of the press, Ms. North. The decision is mine and mine alone, to be made on the basis of the evidence presented. And so it is for me to decide the relevance of Mr. Costello's line of questioning. If I feel it bears merit, I'll allow it. If not, it will be disregarded.
And will it be disregarded by every potential juror who reads the Pioneer Press or watches CARE 11 News? Ellen argued.
We may not have a jury seated, Your Honor, but we have a gallery who will act as jury and judge. If Mr. Costello has to make this lame argument, please let him do it in sidebar.
The judge's eyes scanned the eager faces in the gallery, every last one of them salivating at the idea of hearing something someone didn't want them to hear.
Sidebar, he declared unhappily.
They arrayed themselves at the side of the bench, Costello and Ellen shoulder to shoulder, flanked by their associates.
Now, by all means, Mr. Costello,
Ellen said under her breath with sharp-edged sweetness, enlighten us as to your big city legal brilliance. Costello smiled.
You'll have to forgive Ms. North, Your Honor. It's understandable she wouldn't want this particular subject raised, the effect of personal relationships on motivation.
The subtext cut to the quick. Ellen was stunned that even he would skate so close to such a dangerous edge. Turning back to the judge, she shifted her body just slightly and planted the heel of her pump on Costello's handmade Italian Oxford, grinding down on his little toe.
Your Honor, Chief Holt and Agent O'Malley were acting in their capacity as law enforcement officers. They are here today testifying in that capacity,
Costello said through his teeth, as he tried to surreptitiously wrench his foot out from under hers.
But as Ms. North well knows, Your Honor, emotions spill over from our personal lives into our professional, particularly in a highly charged situation, which this obviously was. If those emotions affected Chief Holt's judgment, I think the court should know about it.
Will it make your client any less guilty? Ellen asked.
My client is an innocent man, victimized by circumstance and Agent O'Malley's desperate attempt to cling to her own professional life.
Ellen narrowed her eyes at him.
Your Honor, may I suggest the only desperate attempts we're looking at here are Mr. Costello's attempts to introduce a wholly inappropriate line of questioning?
No, you may not, Grabko said. You will kindly stop trying to make my decisions for me, Ms. North, and remember your place here in this courtroom.
My place?
Cameron nudged her back a step in warning.
Your Honor, I don't have as much experience in this type of proceeding as Ms. North or Mr. Costello, he said, his freckled face shining with humility. But I thought the defense, if they are to present a case at all, are to bring hard evidence that is clearly exculpatory in nature rather than speculative theory. Am I wrong about that?
Grabko's expression softened somewhat at the opportunity to play law professor, and the tension diffused.
You're correct, Mr. Reed.
However, statements can be exculpatory, can they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And theoretically, even a statement from a prosecution witness can be considered such if given proper weight and light.
And fertilized by the right defense attorney. Cameron's attempt at diplomatic steering had just been bent into a pretzel by Grabko's love of the sound of his own voice.
Proceed with caution, Mr. Costello, Grabko went on. I want to hear a definite point made in the questioning, not counsel giving testimony in the guise of cross-examination.
Costello nodded.
Of course, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ellen refused to give him the satisfaction of looking at him. Taking no chances, Cameron physically turned her back toward their table.
Nice try, Opie, she said under her breath.
He leaned his head toward hers as he took his seat.
You're pissing him off, Ellen.
He's pissing me off.
Yeah, but his fate isn't in your hands.
In my dreams. Costello resumed his place behind the defense table, maintaining distance from the witness stand.
Chief Holt, is it true you and Agent O'Malley are involved personally?
Mitch's jaw hardened.
I don't see how that's any of your damn business, Mr. Costello.
Grabko leaned toward the box.
You'll answer the question, Chief Holt, and please refrain from using profanity in my courtroom.
Yes, Your Honor. He responded grudgingly, glaring at Costello.
Yes, we are. So, when you saw Agent O'Malley in danger, in pain, your reaction went beyond ordinary professional concern.
Yes.
You wanted to get the person responsible, and Agent O'Malley told you the person responsible was Dr. Garrett Wright.
Yes.
You believed the person you were pursuing was Dr. Wright. Dr. Wright lives on Lakeshore Drive. The chase took you in that direction. And when you saw someone going into Dr. Wright's garage, you pursued, even though you admit you had lost sight of your suspect for an unknown period of time. Isn't that correct?
Seconds, Mitch specified.
A heartbeat. What are you getting at, Costello? Spit it out and spare us the theatrics.
He wanted to punch the smug little smile off Costello's face, and he realized that the distance the attorney was keeping between them was aggravating him more than if the son of a bitch had been standing a foot away, as he had done with Megan.
You wanted to see Agent O'Malley keep her position here as regional agent, didn't you?
Agent O'Malley is an excellent cop.
And your lover.
And Agent O'Malley had decided, based on virtually no evidence, that Dr. Wright was guilty. She told you Dr. Wright was the one. You pursued Dr. Wright.
I pursued the suspect,
Mitch corrected him, his blood boiling at the insinuation.
I apprehended the suspect. I didn't give a damn if he was Dr. Wright or Dr. Spock.
It never occurred to you that the man you ultimately apprehended and the suspect you chased through the woods in the dead of night were not the same person?
Never.
Dr. and Mrs. Wright live at 93 Lakeshore Drive, is that correct?
Yes.
Can you tell me who lives just two houses north? At 97 Lakeshore Drive.
The Kirkwoods.
Paul Kirkwood?
Yes.
No further questions, Chief Holt.
Ellen watched Costello as he settled into his chair.
He's really going to do it, isn't he?
Cameron whispered.
He's going to try to pin this on Josh's father.
He'll do whatever he has to, she murmured. Garrett Wright and his shadow aren't the only ones playing a game here.
She rose again, just as Grabko started to dismiss the witness.
Redirect, Your Honor?
Impatience flashed in Grabko's eyes, but he grumbled a yes and sat back to pet his beard.
Are the houses on Lakeshore Drive numbered on the backside, Chief?
Not that I'm aware of.
So when you followed the suspect into that garage, you didn't know if you were in 93 Lakeshore Drive, or 95, or 91?
I had no idea. It didn't matter.
The suspect you chased through the woods was dressed in black, is that correct, Chief?
Yes. Black pants, black boots, black jacket.
And how was Dr. Wright dressed when you apprehended him?
He was in black pants, black boots, and a black ski jacket.
Did he show signs of physical exertion?
Yes, he was breathing hard, perspiring.
And do you have any idea what the temperature was that evening?
About 20 degrees with a wind chill factor of 6 degrees.
Not the kind of night the average person would break a sweat, was it?
Objection.
Withdrawn, Ellen said, biting down on a sly smile.
In regards to the tests for gunpowder performed on Dr. Wright's hands, would the outcome of the tests be affected if he had been wearing gloves at the time he'd used the gun?
Yes.
No further questions, Chief Holt.
Thank you.
The final witness for the prosecution was a criminalist from BCA headquarters in St. Paul. Norm Earlbeck had been on the scene the night of O'Malley's abduction, had been the one to collect the blood-stained sheet that had been draped around Megan. Ellen showed him photographs of the sheet taken at the scene and at headquarters.
Is this the sheet?
Mr. Earlbeck?
Yes, it is.
He nodded, a big square head that sat like a block atop a big square body. His voice was the deep, sonorous voice of authority that caught Grabko's attention and held it. Ellen handed the photographs over to the clerk. The sheet is still undergoing some tests in the lab. Is that correct? She asked, coming back toward her witness.
Yes. The DNA tests will take another 4 to 5 weeks to complete.
But there have been some conclusive preliminary findings, have there not?
Yes, there have been. Two distinct types of blood were found on the sheet. O positive, which is the blood type of Agent O'Malley, and AB negative, which is the blood type of Josh Kirkwood.
And the extensive DNA tests now being conducted will determine if indeed the AB negative blood is in fact Josh Kirkwood's, correct?
Yes.
Hairs were also found on the sheet?
Yes. Hairs that were tested against samples and were found to be consistent in type with Agent O'Malley, Josh Kirkwood, and the defendant, Dr. Garrett Wright. There were also hairs from an unidentified fourth person.
What about the ski mask found along the trail of pursuit, Mr. Earlbeck? Were hairs also found on that?
Yes. Hairs that were consistent with the defendant, and also hairs that matched those unidentified from the sheet.
Thank you, Mr. Earlbeck. I have no further questions.
Mr. Earlbeck,
Costello said, before Ellen was even back to her seat, is the analysis of hair an exact, reliable science?
No, it is not.
You can't make an absolutely positive identification as to whether a hair found on a sheet belongs to a particular person based strictly on the study of the hair itself.
No, sir.
Do you have any way of determining who last wore that ski mask?
No, sir.
And do you have any way of knowing precisely how any of the hairs came to be on that sheet?
No, I do not.
Could they have been deliberately placed on the sheet?
Possibly. No further questions.
We have enough, Cameron said, ignoring the chairs and sitting on the credenza. Phoebe handed him a white deli sack and placed Ellen's on the table without looking at her. Ignoring her secretary's peek and the food, Ellen paced the length of the conference table. She was too nervous to eat. Their part of the hearing had gone well enough, even with Costello scoring a few points. But the afternoon would be Tony's show, and what little control she'd had in the morning would be taken from her.
"We've got more than enough," Mitch said, pacing the lane on the other side of the table.
"Even if Grabko is tempted to buy into Costello's bullshit, there's more than enough weighing on Wright to push him into a trial. Grabko would never have the guts to cut him loose."
But how much nerve would it take, Ellen wondered, with the press shouting out all the things Garrett Wright could not have done. He could not have brought Josh home. He couldn't have taken Dustin Holloman or killed Dustin Holloman. That was the public's focus now, the monster at large. Grabko's decision was to be based on law, but he was just a man, as susceptible to rumor and pressure as anyone.
"It's pretty clear which way he's leaning," she said. "I haven't seen a judge give that much leeway in a pre-trial since Perry Mason went off the air. I'm sorry he let Costello put you through that, Megan."
Megan sat at the end of the table, looking small and battered, as if the ordeal of the morning had caused her to pull in on herself.
"I'm the one who should apologize," she mumbled, eyes down. "I know better than to let some asshole lawyer punch my buttons."
The tension in her voice, in the set of her jaw, hinted at a torrent of emotion building up behind the walls Megan erected around herself. Ellen had seen it happen before. Cops made lousy victims. They were by nature control freaks. Victims were stripped of all control, all pride, all dignity.
"It's not your fault, Megan," she said. "He made me look like a raving lunatic who'd say anything, do anything, to get that arrest on my record."
"Or, like someone who was damn sure of her facts and set on convicting a guilty man," Ellen countered. "It's all in your perception. People see what they want."
"We know what they want to see when they look at Wright," Megan said. Nobody wanted to believe a man like Garrett Wright was capable of evil. And with the death of Dustin Holloman,
the people of Park County would be even less willing to accept Wright as their devil.
"So we have to prove them wrong," Ellen said, her gaze direct, her meaning clear.
Megan nodded.
"Yes, we do."
Chapter 32. The defense calls Dr. Garrett Wright to the stand, Costello announced, setting the crowd buzzing, a noise that